From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump travels to Minnesota and Wisconsin today to rally supporters in those swing states and try to undercut the message from Democrats who begin their national convention tonight to nominate their 2020 ticket, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
It will be almost entirely online because of the pandemic. So let's get to our political strategist to set the table. Jamal Simmons, a Democratic strategist, and Matt Mikowiak, Republican strategist. Neither in Milwaukee, where the convention is supposed to be tonight. Jamal, let me start with you. In 2016, the Democrats were divided. This year, they're united, at least when it comes to getting rid of President Trump. We're not going to have throngs of convention goers cheering this week. But what do you think needs to happen for this convention to be a success?
Well, somebody needs to figure out how to organize virtual happy hours that I can skip because I'm tired and I want to go to sleep for my early morning breakfasts that I have to go to at the convention. Nobody, this is the loss of the this just coming together as a convention can't be overstated. I think Democrats around the country are all lamenting the idea that we're not able to exchange ideas in formal and informal ways. So what the convention organizers are going to have to do is find a way to tie us in to the speeches, tie us in to the content, the momentousness of where we are, so that people get at least a taste of what all of us who've been to conventions before remember, which are not going to get. I just don't know how you replicate is that feeling you get like the one that was had in 2004 when Barack Obama was giving his first nationally telecast speech. And all of a sudden, a crowd of people that normally are super chatty with each other stopped talking and turned to the stage and were just captivated by this new national figure. Mm-hmm. And obviously, we know 4 years later, he became president of the United States.
And Matt, you know, as you look at the convention that starts tonight and also the Republican convention, which is also going to be mostly online like this, do you expect to have any polling bumps come out of these conventions like we usually see?
So, yeah, I think one of the big questions is what is the television audience going to be? You know, I've been thinking about this because there's less anticipation for both conventions than there has been in a while. I was actually thinking about it tonight. I'm not even sure I know who's actually speaking tonight. I mean, I saw a list of
Bernie Sanders and Michelle Obama are two of them. But yes, okay.
That's right. I did see it was Bernie Sanders. But my point is, I feel like in previous years, we all had a pretty good sense of that. And you do have some other competition, right? You have the NBA playoffs start today and tonight. You have the NHL playoffs, which are going on in Major League Baseball. So I just have to wonder whether the TV audience is going to be large enough for either side to get a bump. I do think there will be anticipation for the VP choice on the Democratic side, see how she does, how she introduces herself, and then see what Biden's speech and message are like on Thursday. And I think Trump's speech will have a good audience. The rest of it, I think, is probably going to be fairly modest. So you could see a modest bump for the Dems this week, modest bump perhaps for Trump next week. I imagine at the end of the two-week period, we'll be about where we are now.
Yeah. But, Matt, I'm wondering, you know, always during conventions, the opposing side goes dark, you know, out of respect. President Trump's going on the road. You know, do you think, is that going to annoy voters, maybe like a swing voter, seem bullying, or maybe blunt any Biden bump?
I could potentially sort of mute it a little bit. It's hard for me to imagine a swing voter would take offense at that, or that it would really move the needle in any real way. I did see the president's going, I think, perhaps on Thursday to sort of bracket.
Basketball teams.
We may have lost Matt.
Where did you pick up Jamal? Yeah.
Yeah,
go ahead.
One thing that's really interesting about tonight is I think what the Democrats have done is they've added in their biggest draws, their biggest stars for every night. So tonight you'll have Michelle Obama who's speaking, right? Remember, Michelle Obama just a year ago or so was selling out, the Barclays Center, which had, 19,000 seats, or the United Center in Chicago, which has almost 24,000 seats. She was selling out these arenas. And so now we're going to put Michelle Obama online. And I'll tell you, I've got a 2.5-year-old, and we watch Michelle Obama reading stories online, every week. Yeah. She's a presence in people's lives that I think will draw. Barack Obama's going to speak one night. Obviously, Kamala Harris and Joe Biden are going to speak. I think what we're seeing is there's a great amount of interest in who's going to be the next president. The question is, how many people do watch? But when you've got polling, the last poll I saw from yesterday said 79% of people who plan, you know, 79% of voters are paying very close attention to this election.
But Jamal, I also want to ask you.
Great likelihood there's a huge number of people who are going to watch.
But I want to ask you, you mentioned polls just real quick. There's a new CNN poll that showed the race tightening. Biden only has a 4-point lead. Now there's other polls that show a wider thing, but 4-point lead. And this is, you know, we have Kamala Harris picked. What does Biden have to do, you know, if the race is tightening, to bring in, let's say, progressives who voted for Sanders and might see Kamala Harris as a moderate? What does he have to do?
Well, you know, some of these polls have Biden up 53%. If a Democrat got 53%, there wouldn't be a Republican left elected in Washington. So there's a natural narrowness, I guess, that's going to occur. I think that CNN poll might be an outlier. Everything else shows it between 7 and 10 or 11 points. But still, at the end of the day, that's about what the gap is going to be, I expect, if Joe Biden will win. Remember, not a single Democrat has won a majority of the white vote since Lyndon Johnson in 1964. And the only Democrat to win the majority of the vote overall was Barack Obama in 2008 and 12, since Jimmy Carter. So there hasn't, the Democrats just don't get that much of the national sway. Mm-hmm. And we just all have to keep that in mind.
We should note that, you know, since it is a virtual convention, we could have what happened just now with Matt's line dropping happened during this convention. That could happen. We'll see. But I want to ask you both about the post office, because this is another big story we should talk about. In an interview with Fox News this morning, President Trump said he'd support more voting booths and early voting, but he continued to discredit state efforts to mail out ballots because of the pandemic. And he defended putting his top donor, Louis DeJoy, in charge of the post office, where he's made changes that could lead to a delay of the delivery of ballots. Listen.
This isn't a Trump thing. This has been one of the disasters of the world, the way it's been run. It's been run horribly. And we're going to make it good. Now, what am I supposed to do? Let it continue to run badly? So if you fix it, they say, oh, he's tampering with the election. No, we're not tampering. First of all,
So, Matt, let me go to you, because if President Trump says it's not going to be safe for there to be a lot of mail-in voting in this election, what is the message then to voters who are scared that they're going to get coronavirus by going into the voting booth and they want to vote by mail?
Yeah, I think the first message is that Dr. Fauci said last week that it's absolutely safe to vote in person as long as the necessary steps are being taken. I mean, unless you are literally not leaving your house at all, it is no more dangerous to go vote in person than it would be to go to the grocery store or the pharmacy or to run an errand. And I highly doubt very many people are staying home, you know, months and months and months at a time. Look, the Republicans have agreed to $10 billion in new funding for the Postal Service. It just is getting bogged down in some of the other disagreements about the coronavirus relief package. There have been some just amazing conspiracy theories thrown around in the last couple of days about, you know, what Trump is doing, what he's not doing, you know, reducing the number of drop boxes that are around. Well, it turns out that started in the Obama years as well. It's a constant, you know, ebb and flow. You know, there was a picture that was widely circulated on Twitter yesterday about, you know, postal boxes not being able to be opened on one side. Well, that has to do with phishing. You know, even the person that Trump appointed was confirmed on a unanimous vote in the Senate. So, look, he's going to be up testifying, I think, August 24th. We can learn more about exactly what they're doing, what they're not doing. I think there are some questions about overtime pay and things like that. But if every single person voted by mail, it's a pretty small percentage of the amount of overall mail that's sent. I mean, Christmas alone is like 10 or 20 times the amount of volume that you'd see just if everyone voted by mail. And we don't want everyone to vote by mail because the system really can't handle that at this stage, you know, five, 6 weeks before people start voting.
Jamal, are you worried about what's going on with the Postal Service? And do you think Democrats can do anything to make sure that everybody feels confident in the security of elections?
Yes, I'm worried about all of it. We have a president of the United States who has shown and stated out loud that why he is doing the things that he's doing. He is trying to defund or keep money from going to the post office to keep from having mail-in ballots because he thinks that will help Democrats win the election. And he's been pretty upfront about his intentionality. I think we do have to be concerned. This is how Trump is successful. Each individual thing he tries to push may make sense on its own. But when you pull back from the individuals and you look at the entire mosaic, what you've seen is a president who is trying to obstruct the election and trying to keep voters from being able to participate. That is what Democrats are worried about. You know, Matt did make one point I do want to say before we go. It may not be that hurtful for an individual to go and vote. You know who is hurtful? The older voters, the older citizens who usually staff polling places like my grandmother used to do. It's very tough to get a woman or a man in their 70s who's retired, who usually does this, to sit there in front of 400 people for the course of a day breathing on them. I think this is a very tough election.
Matt, I just got to ask you one question. We only have a half a minute here, but that's COVID-19. Does President Trump own this huge health care failure? The U.S. is doing terribly.
Well, it's certainly an issue he's got to explain better. What steps they've taken, what they've learned, how we're going to be in a better position a month from now, several months from now. I think these are questions he has to answer. Certainly no one can be satisfied with 170,000 people.
Well, we have to end it there. Mac Nikoviak, the Republican, Jamal Simmons, the Democrat. Thank you both so much. It's Here and Now. Critics say President Trump and his top donor-turned-postmaster general are combining efforts to slow down postal service ahead of the election. President Trump says mail-in ballots are plagued by fraud. Let's back up and get a primer. What is a mail-in ballot? Is there a lot of fraud? What impact has Postmaster General Louis DeJoy had? Will ballots be counted in time? The president and Ivanka Trump, as well as many among the White House staff, have already requested absentee ballots. The president says it's because Republican-led Florida can handle them, Democratic-led states can't. And today he repeated this.
Absentee ballots are great. They work. They've been proven. They're good, like in Florida. But this universal mail-in is a very dangerous thing. It's fraught with fraud and every other thing that can happen.
Wait, universal? And is there a difference between absentee and mail-in ballots? Let's bring in MIT political scientist Charles Stewart. Charles, you tell us mail-in ballots and absentee ballots are pretty much the same.
Pretty much the same thing. And I should also say there's a bit of a misnomer, which is that in the states that have been doing this the longest, and I'm talking about Oregon, Washington, for instance, the states mail ballots to voters, but most voters don't mail them back. Most voters actually return them in person. Many states have actually, although you still have to apply for what we would used to call an absentee ballot, they have changed the laws to call those ballots now mail ballots. And a good example is Florida, which several years ago went through their election code and removed all reference to absentee ballots and replaced those references with mail ballots.
But anybody can request an absentee ballot at any time?
There are still a few states that require you to state an excuse, and they have a limited number of excuses. And those are usually that you are infirm or are traveling out of town on election day. And I'm thinking here of states like Texas, Tennessee, I believe Alabama is another one of them. These states are being challenged in the courts, by the way. But in most states, you either don't need an excuse or, I mean, New Hampshire is a good example, where they've said for this election, we will take COVID concern as being a good enough excuse.
Let's start to break it down, because there are about five states that have been doing it. Four are joining in this year. So in nine states in Washington, D.C., every registered voter will be mailed a ballot ahead of the election, those nine states. 33 are offering it now in addition to poll voting because of COVID. Talk a little bit more about how it works. You know, some people might drop it off in boxes, some people might walk it in, and some voters across the country might mail it in. And what that means when it comes to this claim of fraud, how much fraud is there? Start with Oregon. They've been doing this since 2000. How much mail-in voter fraud has been seen there?
The amount of mail-in voter fraud in Oregon, which has been doing it the longest, is so little that no one has made reference to it. And in these vote-by-mail states, what we're especially not seeing is wholesale fraud where, you know, there are hundreds or thousands of ballots being manufactured or somehow fraudulently returned. One of the things that makes me realize that President Trump has not been talking out of a deep well of knowledge in this area, because certainly the Oregons, the Washingtons, the Colorados that have been doing this the longest, you can say a lot of things about the mail ballot system. But one of the things you're not going to say about those states is that they're rampant with fraud.
Well, you put some numbers on it. You say that it translates across the states to about 0.00006% of total votes cast. In Oregon, I think it was 0.00004%. In other words, it's about five times less likely that there's going to be voter fraud than getting hit by lightning in the United States.
Absolutely. And I think it's pretty clear, if you're concerned about mail balloting, voter fraud in these vote-by-mail states is not where you would start. I mean, look, I mean, the states that have been doing vote-by-mail the longest, they recognize the opportunities for fraud, and they worked up to the vote-by-mail system over a number of years, if not decades. They have systems in place, signature matching systems, for instance. Voter registration rolls, the addresses, are probably the cleanest in the nation. They understand that if fraud were rampant, these election systems would crumble in the public's eyes and the eyes of the legislature.
Yeah. Well, what about states taking it up for the first time or offering it because of COVID in addition to their regular polling? I mean, what about the claim that in states where they haven't done it before, somebody could take a ballot from somebody who's died or moved and use it? Do you have fears?
I don't have great fears, but I think we have to start with acknowledging that when you send a ballot out into the world, you are giving bad actors opportunities to act badly. And you need to make sure that, you know, the systems are in place to catch people voting for other folks.
Yeah. Like what? What would the best system be?
The systems to guard against fraud are based on signature matching. And one of the things that vote-by-mail states have largely done is that they've automated signature matching. They can collect numerous signatures from voters so that they can compare your signature across maybe the wet signature you gave when you signed up on a paper ballot, maybe the signature you used the last time you renewed your driver's license at the DMV. And so you can compare a lot of signatures. You can do it quickly. All states basically do a version of that. The issue becomes, in these new states, you haven't invested in collecting a sweet portfolio of signatures. You're going to be matching signatures manually. We saw this in New York during their primary as a prime example. Mm-hmm. These are the issues that voters and policymakers need to be focused on. The real danger is that legitimate voters either end up having their ballots rejected because their signature has changed, or, as we've seen in a number of states, the counting has taken weeks.
We'll talk about the counting, because people are pointing to video of some of these mass sorting machines being moved out of some postal offices. And there's been a cry that the new Postmaster General, DeJoy, has been undercutting the service by moving some of this machinery or boxes. We also heard from Jessica Huseman, who covers the post office from ProPublica. She says, you're looking the wrong direction. Don't worry about those sorting machines. Be looking at Postmaster General DeJoy's cutting back on overtime or saying that mail ballots will no longer be priority mail, a sense that he is slowing down post office service. Do you have concerns as well?
I do have concern, but as Jessica Huseman said, many of these changes were happening already, that the Postal Service is challenged these days. Many of those challenges are not going to be fixed in the next 2 months. And so many of the warnings that are being given to state and local officials, they've known about this for a long time. One election official responded to a tweet of mine yesterday about the letters sent to the states about delays and how long it will take ballots to get to voters and get back. This election official said it was a, quote, nothing burger, because they knew this already. These challenges have been there all along. It's been why I and other people have been saying that if you want to vote by mail, you need to have a plan. You need to request a ballot early. You need to return it early. If your state has a tracker, you need to make sure it's gotten back. So we have to be concerned about this. But there are ways that voters, nonetheless, can protect their ballot.
Okay, well, let's talk just a little bit more about that, because lawyers for President Trump's campaign have been fighting in Nevada, for instance, to block that state from sending ballots to all registered voters. They've been trying to prevent Pennsylvania from using ballot drop boxes. If you're thinking of doing it for the first time, is it better to walk it in somewhere than to mail it?
I would say if you can walk it in, walk it in. In the Washington, Oregon's, Colorado's, most of those voters are walking their ballot in, usually to a drop box. And in fact, in most states, you're not allowed to walk your mail ballot into a precinct.
Where would you walk it into if not a precinct?
To the county office, the municipal office, to a drop box.
Well, this is where some critics see it as political, because President Trump claims that mail-in voting will disadvantage Republican candidates. And some are seeing his efforts in states like Pennsylvania to suppress Democratic votes. Is there a sense that mail-in balloting somehow disadvantages Republicans more than Democrats?
There's gotten to be this kind of folk wisdom that mail balloting disadvantages Republicans. Empirically, it's just not true. In Florida, for instance, in the primary this spring, I had a team here at MIT look deeply into Florida. But Florida has a third of its ballots by mail. In the Florida primary, Republicans voted by mail at a much higher rate than Democrats did. So, you know, it depends on what the campaigns are doing. If Donald Trump's campaign decided it wanted to turn out its base by mail, it could do so. And in fact, I would argue that given the demographic makeup of Donald Trump's voters, he should.
Because they may be older, is that what you're saying, and worried about COVID-19?
Yes, because Trump's voters may be older and might have these health concerns.
MIT political scientist Charles Stewart. So if I'm hearing you, insignificant amount of fraud when it comes to mail-in ballots, you're more likely to be struck by lightning. But it's a good idea to get them in early if you're going to do it, because election officials may have trouble processing. May take some time.
May very well take some time, and it's going to take some time to get that ballot through the postal system back to the counting office.
Professor Stewart, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
So again, unlikely someone's going to go around to the homes of people who've moved to try to snag their ballots. And turns out, by the way, some post boxes being moved. That was long planned. They need to be upgraded. But are you worried about voting? Let us know. HereAndNow.org. Thousands of factory workers took to the streets of Belarus today and over the weekend to demand the resignation of authoritarian President Alexander Lukashenko, who's ruled this former Soviet republic for more than a quarter century. He claimed victory in the August 9th election, but his opponents say the vote was rigged. Joining us now, the BBC's Abdujalil Abdurasulov in the capital, Minsk. Describe what you're seeing there.
Well, yesterday there was a huge crowd that gathered in Minsk. And this is unprecedented for Belarus. It was just a week ago, this was unimaginable, having such a huge crowd chanting leave to President Lukashenko. They're saying that they're ready to come out onto the streets every single day until President Lukashenko steps down.
Well, how likely is that? He spoke today. What did he say?
Yes, today President Lukashenko was meeting with workers who are on strike. He was trying to convince them in saying that the election results were not rigged, as these workers were claiming. The crowd went mad. People were shouting at him, saying there were massive falsifications and systematic falsifications there. And what President Lukashenko said in response was quite interesting. At one point, he actually suggested he would step down once there is a new constitution. And he said that his team is working on a new version and there will be a referendum on this new constitution. But he made it clear he would not tolerate mass protests. He would not leave presidency under the pressure of mass protests.
Interesting. What do you think the chances of that are, his stepping down if there's a new constitution? And just be clear, is there any chance that there are that many people in Belarus, even close to that many people, supporting him?
Yesterday, there was a rally, a pro-Lukashenko rally in Minsk. There were probably maybe 4,000 people who gathered there, but we heard a number of reports that state employees were forced to go to that meeting. And it's very hard to see how President Lukashenko can stay in power, because his image of legitimacy has been shattered. His rule is based on this claim that he is popular. And when there's so many people are on the streets chanting him to leave, it's very hard to maintain that kind of image.
Yeah. Just briefly, Abdul-Jalil, EU foreign ministers said on Friday they feel the election wasn't free or fair. But do they have any options? And what about Russian President Vladimir Putin? We know Lukashenko spoke with him over the weekend. What's his interest here?
For President Lukashenko, Russia's support is probably key in order to maintain his grip on power. And he has already had at least two phone conversations with President Putin. And the EU put pressure on Lukashenko's regime before, or after the previous elections, there were sanctions imposed on Belarus, but then these sanctions were lifted. So for President Lukashenko, the external pressure is not that significant compared to what he is facing here on the ground. His primary concern is all these crowds that are gathering now on the streets across the country, because his legitimacy, he is losing his legitimacy, and it is really difficult for him now to carry on and ruling this country.
The BBC's Abdul-Jalil Abdulrasulov in Minsk, Belarus. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Each week leading up to the election, we're checking in on Senate races in our Here and Now Senate Tracker series. And this week we are doing a doubleheader on two Senate seats up for grabs in Georgia. Stephen Fowler is political reporter with Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Jeremy.
Okay, so let's start with the Senate seat that is currently held by Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler. She was appointed to the seat and took office in January after Johnny Isaacson resigned for health reasons. The special election in Georgia will determine who serves the rest of Isaacson's term until 2022. Let's start with Kelly Loeffler. Tell us more about her and what she's running on.
Right. So Kelly Loeffler is largely been absent from politics. She is a wealthy businesswoman working in the financial services industry and kind of represented a more moderating influence in this era of President Trump and things like that. But she is largely untested. She's trying to introduce herself to voters while also being a sitting U.S. senator. So it's a very unique position, saying this is who I am and this is why you should keep me in the Senate.
Well, and voters may know something about her, which is that she was in the news because of some suspicious looking stock trades that she made early on in the pandemic that appeared to show she was making those trades on insider information. Now, she denies that, and the Justice Department has dropped its probe into those trades. She's also the co-owner of the Atlanta Dream, the WNBA team, and has gotten criticism for speaking out against the WNBA's support of the Black Lives Matter movement. Here she is defending herself on Fox News last month.
I had to speak out for those that disagree with this movement because our country's too important. And I suggested that we unite behind the American flag because that is the symbol that has endured wars, pandemics. Mm-hmm. It can bring us together.
How is she handling the criticisms of her in this race?
She has kind of reveled in this public fight between the Black Lives Matter movement and Democrats as kind of a way to burnish her credentials as a bona fide conservative Republican. Part of that is because of the other prominent Republican in the race, Congressman Doug Collins.
Well, let's talk about him, because this is a special election. She's running against both Democrats and Republicans. If no one wins a majority, there's going to be a runoff in January. Here's an ad from Doug Collins.
I'm Doug Collins, and I approve this message.
Kelly Loeffler's using her family fortune to falsely attack President Trump's strongest defender, to hide what she's done. After a private briefing, Loeffler said we'd be fine. But she dumped millions in stock, invested in three companies that would profit, while many of us lost everything. Now, Kelly's using high-priced lawyers to help her get away with it. You can't trust Kelly Loeffler.
Now, people may remember Doug Collins defended the president during the impeachment hearings and the impeachment trial. Tell us more about his candidacy.
Well, so Doug Collins represents one of the most conservative districts in the U.S. House in the country. So he has kind of staked himself out to the right of the sitting senator and forced both Republican candidates to kind of veer into the right, into the camp of the president, and kind of highlighting these culture war sentiments in a play to try to reach that Republican base, which is going to be the important constituency to make sure that one or both of them gets into the runoff.
The Democratic frontrunner in the race is Ebenezer Baptist Church pastor Raphael Warnock. Let's listen to a campaign video from him.
Well, I've committed my whole life to service and helping people realize their highest potential. I've always thought that my impact doesn't stop at the church door. That's actually where it starts. And I love this country. And I believe that what makes America so great is that we've always had a path to make it greater.
What is Pastor Warnock running on?
Well, you know, Jeremy, I mentioned earlier that Senator Loeffler and Doug Collins are kind of responding to the movement and responding to the national political landscape. Warnock is doing the same. He's the pastor of a prominent church in Atlanta that has a rich history in civil rights. Warnock has positioned himself on a campaign platform of civil rights and human rights and voting rights. You know, he was there and part of the funeral for Representative John Lewis, where you had three presidents speak. He is pitching himself as a progressive and taking on a message of more positive change than trying to necessarily, you know, take down Republicans or things like that.
What did the polls say about this race, or what would you expect is going to happen? Are we going to end up with a January runoff, and who might be in it?
Well, since there are 21 candidates that are on the ballot in this race, many of them lesser known, it's a math problem, but many political handicappers actually say it will head to a runoff, and because of that runoff, they think it's a seat that is more certain to know the outcome than Georgia's other Senate seat, but you will likely see two of those three people, Kelly Loeffler, Doug Collins, and Raphael Warnock, in that January runoff that could potentially decide control of the U.S. Senate.
Okay, let's talk about the other race, and that is where Democrat John Ossoff is trying to unseat Republican Senator David Perdue. And let's start with Perdue, elected in 2014. Here's a recent campaign ad from him.
Do we need police reform? Absolutely. But is defunding the police the answer? Absolutely not. Our officers need to look more like the communities they serve. De-escalation training is a must. Body cameras would help. Real police reform will make all of our neighborhoods safer and ensure justice for all.
What has Senator Perdue's record been like, and what's he running on?
So David Perdue pitched himself to Georgians 6 years ago as an outsider, somebody who is not entrenched in politics. He's a CEO of several companies, a long business career. And in his time in the Senate, he has largely kept up that moniker. But given all the changes that have happened in our world and in our politics, you hear that message where he's talking about police reform, but not defunding the police. And so he is pitching himself still as an outsider, but somebody who's a little bit more attuned to maybe some moderate policies than, say, a Doug Collins or a Kelly Loeffler fighting for that farther right Republican base.
Does that mean he's not aligning himself closely with President Trump?
I wouldn't say that any Republican in Georgia is not aligning themselves with President Trump, but I think it's just how closely and how often they choose to mention the president. Now, I mean, the thing to think about with two Senate races on the ballot, there have been about 55 instances historically where both senators have been on the ballot at the same time, and only eight of them have resulted in a split result where a Republican and a Democrat won. And so you have to kind of think about the bigger picture. It's not just David Perdue running against John Ossoff.
Okay, well, let's talk about John Ossoff. He's a former investigative journalist. He ran before, and he spoke with 11 Alive News in Atlanta in June. Here he is.
We can ensure every single Georgian has great health care. We can rebuild this economy with investments in infrastructure and clean energy. And we can strengthen civil rights and voting rights in this country.
So those are some of the messages that Democrats are using in other places as well. Tell us more about Ossoff and what he's running on this time around.
Well, this time around, I think there's a big concern in Georgia right now with the way the state and the country is handling COVID-19. There are high numbers of cases and deaths in Georgia, and there's no statewide mask mandate. And so Ossoff and other Democrats are kind of capitalizing on that, as well as their healthcare message to say, under our administration, if you elect me to Senate, you won't have to worry about health, things like that, because we'll take care of you. And so I think John Ossoff is really responding to the politics of now, which is a constantly changing, evolving, emotionally driven set of circumstances.
Now, the polls in this race seem to give an edge to Perdue, but within the margin of error.
That's right. I mean, it's a very, very close race. Plus, Georgia has been demographically shifting over the last decade. In 2018, a couple of House seats flipped. There are a couple more seats that are up for grabs that could be changing hands. And you have an increasingly younger, more diverse Georgia population that could be this year what tips Georgia into the Democratic column come November 3rd.
Into the Democratic column in the presidential election as well?
Potentially. That's what Georgia Democrats say, that this is the year that Georgia goes completely blue. And with the amount of money and resources that President Trump's campaign and other Republicans have put in, that's certainly a possibility they're preparing for as well.
That is Stephen Fowler, political reporter with Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Stephen, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
What a year to be a political reporter in Georgia.
Families have been inspired to have deeper conversations about racism since the death of George Floyd, a mosaic of conversations across the country. Rhonda Taylor Bullock, who is Black, is a pro at this. She's the co-founder of We Are, a nonprofit committed to anti-racist education based in Durham, North Carolina, and she teaches children of all skin colors how to talk about racism. But Rhonda and her 9-year-old son Zion got together recently to ask each other some difficult questions.
Hi, my name is Rhonda Taylor Bullock. I'm the co-founder of We Are.
Hi, my name is Zion Bullock, and I'm the son of the co-founder of We Are.
He's funny.
Why did you start We Are?
I was thinking about you and ZZ, so that hopefully when you all get older, or even now, as you all are growing up, that, you know, for one, you're better prepared for the racism that exists in the world, for people who are going to treat you differently because of your skin color.
When was the first time you noticed someone treated you unfairly based on your skin color?
I was 5, and I was in kindergarten, and one of my classmates went around and invited everybody at the table to her birthday party except for me. And then I asked her, I said, why didn't you invite me, you know, to your birthday party? And she said, well, you can't come to my birthday party because my dad said Black people are not allowed in our home.
That's messed up.
It is messed up. Remember when we had that incident in our neighborhood? Was that your first time where you think you paid attention to being treated unfairly because of the color of your skin? Or do you think it has it happened at other times?
I feel like it was just that one time, and it did make me very sad.
Can you tell us, like, what happened?
The kid who was talking to me, he was white, and he said that his mom was crazy. And I was like, why? And he said, it's because we have a Black person living in our neighborhood. And my heart just fell. I was really sad.
I remember you being upset because he said my mom would freak out if she knew I was down here with you. And I was very proud of you because in that moment, you knew to ask. You were like, why would your mom freak out? Then remember his mom started coming down the street. Do you remember what you tried to do?
Run?
You try to run behind me. You ran and hid behind me, and I was like, Zion, what are you doing? Do you remember what you said?
No, I do not.
You said, I don't want his mom to see that I'm Black.
That's what I thought you would say.
That's what you thought. It's okay. I mean, you know, sometimes we remember things. Sometimes it's hard. But you were young. Six is young. Do you remember when I told you about George Floyd? When I remember when I told you, you said, Mom, can we just... You put your hand up. You said, stop. Can we just pause and breathe for a second?
I remember telling y'all to take a pause so we would remember about him.
Felt like you checked me and was like, Mama, this is sad. Like, we can't just tell the story and move on. Like, we need to pause and pay attention that somebody lost their life, and that life mattered.
It's a little rough being a kid, especially during this time, because I always feel like something's watching me and it's about to shoot me, and I feel like I just get scared and I always feel like I gotta run to somebody, and so I just feel like I'm in a little dark space, nowhere to go, and I just feel scared.
Yeah, that's heavy. It was interesting to hear how you described it, especially because we're talking about guns, we're talking about shooting, we're talking about violence, and how you are processing that it feels like someone is chasing you. And that's sad. I definitely understand. What do you think we should do?
I think what we should do is do one more protest, but this time everybody who cares about Black lives and everybody who is Black should like join together and like make sure all the cops hear what they have to say. What do you hope for in the future?
All the things. I hope that you and Zaire and kids like you all get to grow up and not have race dictate your outcomes. And where you all grow up, where the systems that are responsible for caring for you, that they're not racist. I hope that's what you all get to experience. My hope, particularly for like Black families and brown families, is that we get peace, that we get to exist and take breaks and rest, because we've been fighting a long time. And I think my hope for white families is that white families are having conversations like we're having to have and talking about race, how race is impactful, and what does it mean to have white skin in this world. My hope is that white folks do their part and to stand alongside Black and brown voices so that we can have a much more socially just society. Like, that's what I hope folks do.
Rhonda Taylor Bullock and her son Zion. Zion, that is messed up, but you make hearts stand up. The story was produced by Liz Schlemmer of member station WUNC. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. What a great story. It's Here and Now. One of the most important tools in fighting the coronavirus is data, information on how the virus is spreading and where it might go next. But the Trump administration has been criticized for trying to hide the facts. Former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer says Americans deserve to see them, and he wants to help. He'll join us next time on Here and Now.